We continue with questions to the Chief Minister. Question number 116, the Honourable T.M. Kane.
Mr. Speaker, for the government to provide an estimate as to when it expects the tunnel of Eastern Beach under the runway to be completed.
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
The city is expected that the tunnel and road under the runway will be completed during the lifetime of the parliament.
Mr. Speaker, can we able to Chief Minister help us with this? Is the tunnel under the runway going to be completed by DJVS, which was the intention of the previous administration? I think that the Honourable Gentleman made statements to the effect that that policy was going to be continued, or is it going to be completed and the works undertaken by some other company?
Mr. Speaker, an announcement will be made by the government when the works are underway in respect of any part of the works which are not currently being finished by DJVS. As the Honourable Gentleman knows, DJVS has done an excellent job already of finishing the roundabout in the area of Beachview Terraces, the southern access road in that area, and have started the dewatering of the tunnel. If anybody else is going to become involved in any other aspect of the work, an announcement will be made.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, but can the Honourable Chief Minister provide some further details and be a little bit more helpful in relation to this? Because, of course, if the work goes to somebody else, then one would expect, unless, of course, the works are going to be undertaken, for example, by OHL, I merely speculate in relation to this, which is the previous contractor, in relation to which the government has these proceedings in London. That it will go out to tender, and therefore, if it goes out to tender, then we are talking about a process that is going to take longer than certainly it could be done within the term of the parliament. Certainly, but it will take longer than just simply continuing the work when DJBS finishes the work that they are presently undertaking.
Because I don't envisage any eventuality which would make my original answer in any way incorrect.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to say for absolute clarity, within the assembly next parliament, so the Chief Minister has given an assurance that the tunnel will be completed within the next 4 years.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think the Honourable Member needs to look at the legislation. I understand the election would be due within 90 days of this Parliament having been sworn in, and so the maximum lifetime of this Parliament is probably just over 4 years.
Question number 117, the Honourable R. M. Clinton.
Can the Minister for Inward Investment please give an update on the Blue Water project and whether the $83 million premium has been or is likely to be paid by Tomorrow Holdings Limited?
Answer, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, at the date that the question was received, the $83 million premium is not due. Discussions are still ongoing with Tomorrow in order to finalise arrangements which would lead to the payment of the premium agreed.
Mr. Speaker, could the Honourable Member give an indication to those members of the public who registered interest in affordable housing as to when they might expect a response?
Mr. Speaker, that is a question that does not arise, in my view, from the question that has been asked. I've been asked, Mr. Speaker, when those who have registered an interest in respect of some of the affordable housing on the east side may expect a response. This is not a question in my view that arises, but I'm quite happy to say that very shortly, I understand.
Thank you very much. And if the Honourable Member would indulge me, in his budget speech in 2015, he also mentioned another project at Sterling Island. Can you give any details on that?
Because I think it really is quite a distance from the East Side, and I have absolutely no difficulty in continuing with this debate, but it would really be something that is not just sort of difficult really to be getting into the question of the administration.
Just to the honourable member, you know, it's a relevant question on the agenda for next meeting.
Thank you. I'll continue on the East Side project. Can the honourable member give an indication as to when he might expect to complete negotiations? I assume that those new people have been described as intense. But given that this project was announced back in June last year, I would expect that the negotiations to be less intense by now. Can you give an indication as to what point the intensity will reach a climax? Talks about either he got the 83 million or he decides to go with another developer.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I don't like to go into the detail of the sort of intensity that the honourable gentleman is talking about, but he can be assured that the climax is coming.
I look forward to very much debating him.
Speaker, he can be assured that I will enjoy it very much indeed.
Question 118, the Honourable Mrs. MDE, stand down.
Mr. Speaker, can the government reveal what financial contribution it is making towards the restoration and relocation of Galton House?
Answer the Honourable Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, the amount donated by government towards Galton House in respect of the relocation and restoration of Galton House is £144,245.
Question number 119, the Honourable D.A.
And Speaker, can the government please say what money has been paid, either directly or indirectly, by the government, a government-owned company, a or agency, whether by way of gift, loan or otherwise, to the GSA or anyone else, in respect to the proposed GSA National Stadium project, either at Waterpoint or elsewhere?
I answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, after discussions with the GSA and WESA, a temporary advance of £929,176 has been made to the GSA, which is due to be repaid with the funding agreed between the GSA and WESA.
Does the Chief Minister have a timeline as to when he expects that £929,000 to be repaid?
Mr. Speaker, during the course of the development of the new stadium,
This must be a matter of contract, and there must be a trigger date for the repayment of the £929,000. The course of the development is likely to take 2 years, 3 years, it may even take 4 years. Can you be more specific in terms of the repayment of this loan of £929,000?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure I can be, but I'm not going to give you notice of the question now with all the details of the agreement entered into with the GSA.
This really is a supplementary that the Honourable Gentleman should have expected because it arises out of the original question. But nonetheless, I will ask the question again next time round. What about in terms of interest? Is this an interest-free loan that is provided to the GSA, or is there interest accrued to the government and obviously the taxpayer on this £929,000?
Mr. Speaker, I didn't anticipate that I was going to be asked the details of the loan. I was asked what amount had been lent, so I wasn't anticipating to be asked this level of detail. But I can tell him it's not an interest-free loan.
Mr. Speaker, if I recall correctly, Mr. Speaker, I have once asked the people about the government what expenses have been incurred in respect of the original development of the football stadium at River Point. And as Angela may have said, I know it was a very low figure, he said something. Does the minister happen to recall there have been no fire expenses or does it require fire notice? I think I can deduce from the answer that's given me, because it's just a low figure, that there have been no other expenses. But if it's not certain, perhaps you can indicate that this is probably the question of some land.
He's absolutely right. There is no other expense. Can the Honourable Chief Minister please give details of through whom the contract is made with the GFA? Is it directly with government or a government principal? If the Honourable Member gives me a notice of the question, I will be able to.
Speaker, I don't mind, I don't really want controversy in the first session of Parliament after the general election. We say one is 6.8 out of 10. People walking up and down the street. But Mr. Speaker, it does actually say, by way of gift, loan or otherwise, it says indirectly or directly by the government, a government owned company, a policy or agency. Now I would have thought it arises out of one of those. And it is definitely an answer that I would have expected to have been provided in the original answer to the question. Or indeed, you know, for the people who come prepared to answer supplementary, because it really is something that arises out of it. But Mr. Speaker, I will give notice on this.
Given the many questions, what money has been paid directly or indirectly by the government, authority, agency, whether by way of gift or otherwise? And the answer that the Chief Minister gave is a temporary advance of $829,100 has been made. The Chief Minister hasn't said which entity has made that advance. I don't know whether he has the information or whether he doesn't, or whether at this stage he doesn't want to produce it.
Because I don't have that information, because the question asks me what money has been paid. It doesn't ask me by who the money has been paid, it asks me what money has been paid. And that's why the answer that has been prepared is the answer that has been given. But look, Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted that at least it's sinking in that almost 7 out of 10 people voted for us at the last election. At least it's a positive outcome for today's question time.
Question number 120, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, how many people have been naturalized British and Gibraltar since the 1st of December 2011? And how many of those, A, qualify to apply to join the housing waiting list, and B, have applied to join that list?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer together with questions 121 and 122.
Question number 121, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, when people have not already done so, do each of those who have been naturalized British and Gibraltar since December 2011 qualify to apply to join the housing waiting list?
Question number 122, the Honourable D.A.
Peterson. Mr. Speaker, how many non-British relatives of those naturalized British in Gibraltar between December 2011 and December 2015 were A, in possession of a residency permit in Gibraltar before their relative was naturalized British, and B, were granted residency permits in Gibraltar after their relative were naturalized British?
I will call the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, since the 1st of December 2011, a total of 1,090 people have been naturalized. Of this, of these, 737 are qualified to apply to join the housing waiting list, and 208 have applied to join. All applicants naturalized who wish to join the housing waiting list are required to provide 10 years' proof of continued residence and to meet the requirements, of course, of the housing scheme. 72 non-British relatives of those naturalized British and Gibraltar between December 2011 and December 2015 were in possession of a residency permit before their relative was nationalized British. 179 were granted residency permits in Gibraltar after their relatives were nationalized British.
question number 123, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please provide details of all those posts within the public service that are currently being substituted for longer than 3 months?
I'll answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the question is answered in the attached schedule. The schedule amounts to 2 pages, so if I suggest we move on to 124, and we as a person can come back and ask him if supplementaries have now arrived in the country.
Question number 124, the Honourable D.A.
And if you can the government please state what has been the cost of all refurbishment, restoration and construction work done to number 6 Pendant Place from the 9th of December 2011 to the 31st of December 2015?
I will tell the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the total cost of the refurbishment, restoration and construction work at number 6 Pendant Place from the 9th of December 2011 to the 31st of December 2015, the new annex in the existing building, is
£6,563.89. Question number 125, the Honourable D.A. Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, on how many occasions from the 9th of December 2011 to the 31st of December 2015 did the Chief Minister or any other minister use the VIP lounge at Gatwick or Heathrow Airport, and what was the total cost per annum of such use?
I answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that the information sought by the Honourable Gentleman is public information which is available on the government website and is updated shortly after each message.
Mr. Speaker, the information is provided in the website. What isn't in the website is a breakdown in relation to what relates to the VIP lounge in Heathrow and the VIP lounge in Gatwick. So if the Honourable Gentleman has that information, and can you please provide it?
I certainly don't have that information. If you want it to be broken down further, not only will it be provided, but I'll make sure that it is added to the government website as a column so that the Honourable Gentleman knows which of the two it is in the future.
And as I said, since 2012, there's been a considerable use by the Honourable Gentleman of the VIP lounge in London. We don't know whether it's the VIP lounge in Gatwick Heathrow, it's probably a combination of both. In 2012, he used the VIP lounge on 2 occasions. In 2013, he used the VIP lounge on 7 occasions, with a cost of £480 to £1,200. He used the VIP lounge on 3 occasions in 2014 with a cost of £600 to £1,280. And he used the VIP lounge last year on 4 occasions with a cost to the taxpayer of between £1,200 and £2,700. In light of the fact that the Honourable Gentleman used to examine the use of the two VIP lounges by Sir Peter Caruana, as his earlier, with the minute detail of a forensic account of examining accounts, and indeed the criticisms of that use, which he used to level at his predecessor, how does he justify that use of the VIP lounge, which he used to criticize when he was leader of the opposition? Mr. Speaker, the other gentleman obviously knew that the information he was asking about was public information when he asked the question, because he was ready with it for his supplementary. But let me tell him that I have flown in the time that he has asked about on 62 occasions. And that I have not used the VIP round on 41 occasions by his reckoning, given the numbers that Sandy said I have used it. That between the period 7th of June, you might want to make a note of this, 2006, and 18th of October, 2011, the Peter Gavrana, then Peter Gavrana, used the round on 78 occasions, at a cost of £32,000 to the taxpayer, although the fees were then considerably lower. So, Mr. Speaker, it seems to me that I am using the VIP round much less than my predecessor used it, following exactly the rules that I indicated I would follow, which are that I would only use it when it was absolutely necessary, that I would not use it just not to go through security. And in fact, the older gentleman should know that most of the occasions when we use it are when we are travelling to transatlantic and we need to connect, and we would not connect if it were not for the VIP round. I will also tell him that the Gatwick round, which is the one that was used many years ago when there was just a link to Gatwick, has an expression to Gibraltar there from the time that it was used by many of my predecessors as one of the entitled users. So, the ratio of use is exactly as it should be, because I was very critical of the former administration using it all the time. I will not use it all the time. I have not used it all the time. The basic math tells me I use it a third of the time I travel. Well, that's the fact. I must apologize to the Honourable Gentleman, because I actually made a mistake. In actual fact, the figures that I quoted were the figures of the use of the VIP line, the Gatwick and the Heathrow, we don't know, just as it gets to London, not transatlantic. So indeed, when you actually take the transatlantic and you add it to the London ones, you're talking about double the number that I quoted and the number that seems so self-satisfyingly quoted back at me. With the comparison, but Mr. Speaker, you see, I've asked him, because this is what I am concerned about, and this is what I am charged to do. I am here to ask questions about government policy. And the policy of the opposition, the then opposition, when he was leading it, was not to spend money on these VIP lounges because they were an expense to the taxpayer that was not justified. And lo and behold, he becomes the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, and he seamlessly slips into exactly the same mode that he criticized of his predecessor. Now, how did he justify the change of policy? Mr. Speaker, he was here for a lot of our time, so I'm surprised he doesn't remember what the debates were about. The debate was about the fact that this lounge is used all the time. Now, he cannot get out of the fact that they've given him the statistics, and in 5 years, in fact, just barely 5 years, almost 4 years, when their party was in government, they moved around 78 times. In more or less the same period of time, I've used it 26, although I've traveled 62. Now, Speaker, I think that demonstrates that we are keeping it to our view that this round should not be used frivolously. We use it when we have to, we use it because we've got very tight connection times. I've used it because I've had meetings at the airport and I would not have been able to do that otherwise. Two-thirds of the time I travel, I do not use it. He needs to understand that when they were here, and what he used to defend was that it should be used all the time. All the time. I did not accept that. I did not think that was the right use of taxpayers' money. And I therefore make sure that it's only used when it's necessary. I know it's very difficult for the Honourable Gentleman to realise that we actually do what we say, that we demonstrate that we care about people's money, and that we would only use this facility when it is necessary for the purposes of conducting government business. Not, as the former Chief Minister said, because he didn't like to show his toes at security.
Mr. Speaker, I don't mind walking around in my set like every other passenger has to do in order to comply with the expectations of today's security requirements at airports. That's not what it's about. We use it when we have to, we don't use it frivolously, and the Honourable Gentleman cannot get off that hook.
Mr. Speaker, let me read to him what he said in supplementary to question 336 of 2011. He said this to the Honourable Peter Caruana, Chief Minister. He said, I accept that, Mr. Speaker, and I accept, of course, that the cost of the Honourable Gentleman not having to take up his tea and throw up his toothpaste is not included today. I'm not going to ask about seeing the toothpaste today. But having now had an opportunity to glance at the schedule, can I commend to the Honourable Gentleman, and would he agree with me that he should really, maybe, stop using this round? Not use it for when it's necessary or essential or essential. Stop using this round. But if he does, can I prevail upon him to at least ensure he goes to Heathrow as often as possible because the cost of the Gatwick round is £793 per trip, whilst the cost of the seat at Heathrow is £470. And although I think that he does not agree, that £470 is already too much to pay, is it not at least better than normal that gentlemen should pay that and not £790? And of course, if you look at the actual schedule, you're talking about £2,700 at times. It's not by no means out of the ordinary that he's been paying that amount of money in relation to these particular lounges. And that's the point, Mr. Speaker. At the time that he was leader of the opposition, he was saying, don't lose it, it's costing too much money. And it's only £470 and £790. And now that it's costing £2,700, it's essential for Gibraltar business work that the Chief Minister for Gibraltar uses it. Now, how did he justify that shift in position from when he was leader of the opposition to now that he is the Chief Minister of Gibraltar, whether he takes his shoes off or he doesn't take his shoes off at the lounge? Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman doesn't factor into any of those calculations the savings that Gibraltar often makes because we don't have to stay overnight in London, because we're able to make connections which we would not otherwise make by the use of the island. And sometimes there may be six of us travelling, or seven of us travelling, or eight of us travelling, and the cost of staying overnight in London would be higher than using the island. But given what we want to talk about, pounds, shillings and pence, then let us do the comparison. Don't you know that the amount spent from the moment that charging was introduced, and I told him it was, in 2006, by the Chief Minister who he defended, at those lower rates, was £43,000. £43,000. And at the higher rate, because we use it much less, the total has been £33,000. So, Mr. Speaker, I'm perfectly comfortable because I know that I'm doing what I need to do to ensure that we save taxpayers' money, that we use the resource that is there sparingly, that we ensure we use it when we need to, and that it's not about, as the former Chief Minister said in answer to an earlier question, which is what led to my remarks in that supplementary, that he used it because he simply couldn't be fast standing at security with everybody else and taking out his tools. Mr. Speaker, that is what being responsible is about. That is what we demonstrate, we ensure we look after taxpayers' money, and we use this resource sparingly and when required. But I do remember, Mr. Speaker, his face of adulation, looking at Sir Peter, then Simple Peter, clapping and banging the table every time he defended the use of that lounge. So that is when Sir Peter wasn't telling him to step up and sit down. Mr. Speaker, I can see the rueful grin of the father of the house when I'm actually going through all these figures and the amount of money that the man that he has placed at number 6 Condon Place is spending all this taxpayer's money when, quite frankly, and in fairness to him, the father of the house, he would never have dreamt for one moment, being the socialist that of course he is, of spending £2,700
on a lounge in Heathrow and Gatwick. But Mr. Speaker, you see, there is a consistency here. Not only did he criticize the previous government in relation to this, now he does exactly the same, but in 2013, he told me, well, I'm only using it for transatlantic flights, really the stopover, which is part of the answer he's given me today. But I looked through the schedule, and I see March 2013, Oxford Nixon Festival with Mr. G. Flower. Oxford Nixon Festival addressed deconstructing self-determination at Christchurch College, Oxford. Attended reception, University College Oxford, dinner at Christchurch, Oxford. I then look at further along the list, and I see meetings in London, meetings with senior officials of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, Conservative Party conference. These are not transatlantic, because if you actually compare it with the dates that we know that the Honourable Gentleman is going to be on transatlantic flight, they're just simple visits to London, so it just simply does not stack up, does it? That he is using these lounges just simply for transatlantic flights. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is referring to information which I have made public. Whether he has discovered something and matched it up with something else, the schedule of what is on the website tells him when I've used it for transatlantic flights and when I've used it for another reason. And if I used it for the purposes of travel which keeps me in the UK, there must have been a very good reason. In other words, I must have needed to get somewhere at a particular time which I would not be able to do other than by using the lounge. That's what he's not getting. It's very simple. The socialist sitting next to me, Mr. Speaker, who is in effect sitting between two other socialists I would have him know, and among seven socialists and three liberals, would be very happy to spend £2,000 if he was saving three, four, or five of those out. So, Mr. Speaker, it doesn't seem to be that the Honourable Member gets it. But look, I will tell him this. He said that I am the person that Joe Bacano has placed at number six from the list. Then he also says, when it speaks him, that I am the Machiavelli who manipulated Joe Bacano into not giving him the crown of the authority and giving it to me. Well, Mr. Speaker, Machiavelli or Maionetta, but not both. He has to make up his mind.
Mr. Speaker, first of all, I really must commend the Honourable Chief Minister, the depth of knowledge he has on this subject when he was unable earlier to answer a question on a DFA loan. I do have a question, of course. I do have a question. The question is fairly straightforward. Bearing in mind the intent of the use of the VIP lounge, we call for the space that's very valid. Would those on the government benches consider travelling in normal economy class and travelling British Airways rather than club class to save further non-short haul flights?
The people we very often do. The Honourable Gentleman, perhaps from his vantage point at the tower, may have seen that we don't often board the plane with the blue and red insignia. We very often go on the orange plane. And on the orange plane, nobody yet has been able to find the club class exception.
Any other supplementary in this country? When the Chief Minister nominates to fly British Airways, isn't it possible for him to say the normal language that many people are accustomed to? I'm not really accustomed to using the normal galleries at British Airways, but there are opportunities for that to happen rather than the VIP language. Unfortunately, I'm not accustomed to the specific VIP language that we are referring to in this thing, but possibly maybe one day I will be. But are there... What other languages are there available that are low cost that include the price of the ticket or the price of the penalty? Mr.
Speaker, for some time since I was a partner of a client, I've enjoyed the benefits of a gold card with British Airways, and so therefore I'm lucky enough to be able to enjoy the gallery lounge at any of the airports is possible. And sometimes I'm even able to wag my way into the first class lounge by bragging about the fact that it's a great car. And it's perfectly adequate, and that's why on
two-thirds of the occasions in which I've traveled, I have used those lounges and not the other lounges. But I am delighted to hear him say that he hopes that perhaps one day he might be able to use the VIP lounge that I'm referring to here today, because therefore he obviously A, believes it should continue to be used, and B, has the intention of moving from that chair to the central chair, at least when you're deciding from there to here, because it's only used by the Chief Minister. There's not a talent in your hands. Grateful for the Chief Minister's comment in relation to I really want to know what the VIP lounge is. Normal people are clearly not used to knowing what a VIP lounge is. I'm grateful that the people have now confirmed that only the Chief Minister is allowed to use the VIP lounge. That is a good thing. I'm grateful. Thank you for that. Yes, Mr. Speaker, just on that note, so people understand what we're talking about, because perhaps people will confuse the VIP lounge with a club lounge at Eastwell and also Gatwick. Can the Honourable Chief Minister just provide some information, just for the purposes of listeners and viewers, in relation to what the VIP lounge is used, apart from just simply sitting at the VIP lounge, also working at the VIP lounge, obviously. It's also a fast track as well in relation to how you move around the airport. Perhaps one of the Chief Minister can explain that for the purpose of the viewers and listeners to this exchange.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to do that. In fact, there is an element about the VIP lounge which is not very VIP at all, which is that there is no food available in the VIP lounge. The galleries and third class experience of the is much better than that respect. There's absolutely no shopping, so if you've got to the airport and haven't bought anything for your wife or children, you're really then in a very difficult position indeed. You have to make the best of it in the aircraft. It is all about actually getting around the airport more quickly, and it's about being collected at the aircraft and being able to get to your car and get out of Heathrow or Gatwick within 10 or 15 minutes of the aircraft landing, and about being moved from one aircraft to another without having to check in again because of coming to a boarding party. And therefore, for that reason, and without, in particular at Heathrow, the issues about arriving at the airport at a particular time. The other gentleman may know, but one is now not allowed through into Heathrow at 10 or 5, even from the check-in area, if you don't at least have, I think it's an hour and 10 minutes, because they reckon you won't be able to make it to the gate. Very often, our connecting times are shorter than that, and what the lounge does is not to allow us to lounge at all. All it does is take us from the aircraft to a car that takes us to the other aircraft and brings us home to the border and takes us to the United States where we may be going. So it's not about lounging, it's not about more luxury, it's actually about the ability to work harder for the border when we use this lounge and to get the best out of every penny that we spend.
I've used the lounge myself, and I can assure our listeners that we're not exactly slumming when we use the VIP lounge.
I'm grateful for that indication, given that the Honourable Gentleman has said that. I should just clarify that the rule that only the Chief Minister can use this lounge or engage the use of it, because there are other ministers who may be travelling with it, is not my rule. It's the rule that was there before. It's the only rule that seems to be sensible to keep, because the other rule was book it every time you go to London. That one I did away with, the one that was only a Chief Minister should use, I kept, with the full support of the 10 people who sit with me on the side of the house.
Right, I suggest we move away from the VIP lounge back to Parliament. Question 126.
Question number 126, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Yes, I used it with the former Chief Minister as well. Mr. Speaker, can the government say how many companies, partnerships or entities owed the government a cumulative amount of more than £50,000 in arrears in each of the financial years since 2011-2012, providing a breakdown by reference to A, KYEG's social insurance, and C, other government debt?
I'm for the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer with question 127.
Question number 127, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say how many companies, partnerships or entities that owed the government a cumulative amount of more than £50,000 in a year in each of the financial years since 2011-2012 have been provided with loans by Credit Finance Company Limited?
I'm for the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, The information as requested is not presently available, as there is one database for tax and social insurance and another for government debt. The response therefore provides the number of companies, partnerships and entities with cumulative arrears for tax and social insurance in excess of £50,000, and separately, those companies, partnerships and entities with arrears of other debts in excess of £50,000. It may well be that there are other entities when you add A, B and C above the exceed, which exceeds the £50,000 limit. However, it is not possible to provide this information in that way. I will give it as follows. In respect of PAYE and social insurance, in financial year 11-12, 63. In financial year 12-13, 74. In financial year 13-14, 53. In financial year 14-15, 43. In respect of other government debt, in financial year 11-12, 23. In financial year 12-13, 29. In financial year 13-14, 28. And in financial year 14-15, 29. Throughout the period of 2012 to 2015, one such company has had arrears in excess of £50,000 in respect of the question that wants to sell in another one. Those were the loans and credit cards.
That concludes questions for the Chief Minister. We now move to question 101. The Honourable Arlene Thompson.
Can the Minister of the Public Finance please advise which government-owned entity or agency has paid or committed to pay £17.5 million for the Midtown Coast car park project, seeing as this amount does not appear as a capital project in the Improvements in Development Fund?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Following the method that was introduced by the previous administration in respect of the car park constructed in previous years, the car park company will be investing in the Midtown car park.
Government owned Gibraltar Car Park Limited, and will it own 100% of that facility?
It will own the car that has been agreed with a contractor and which has not been put on sale. I mean, there are spaces that have been sold to members of the public, and those clearly will not be a part of it. But the financing of the construction reflects the amount of car parking that will belong to a car park company.
Would I be correct in saying that the car park sold to the general public, that money will not accrue to the government? If perhaps the honourable member could give some information as to how the member has been financed by the government.
The money that comes in from the sale of a car park goes to finance the building that is not financed by the car park company. The final account will be that the car park company will be paying for the one that it remains with because they're not being sold to the public, and therefore if there's a rented, they will produce a revenue. In all the previous car parks that have been financed in this way, it has been the revenue from the rented that has served the cost of the investment. The same model is being assigned.
Question number 102, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Can the Minister of Public Finance please provide the total gross debt, cash reserves and net debt figures for public debt for each of the following month ends, namely July 2015, August 2015, September 2015, October 2015, November 2015, and December 2015.
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question to question 103. No breaches of the net debt limit or debt service ratio as set in the public finance form of our Act 2008 at any time in the period from December 2011 to December 2015 inclusive.
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the gross debt at the end of this month, from July to November 2015, has been 447.7 million. In other words, it has been changed. The cash reserves in the same month have been 27 million, 30.7 million, 13.6 million, 34.6 million, and 16.6 million. The net debt for the same month has been 420 million, 417 million, 434.1 million, 413.1 million, and 431 million. As regards the breach mentioned in the question, no such breach of the limit of ratio has taken place at any time in the period December 2011 to December 15.
Thank you. I think I have numbered for 5 months there, rather than six. Could the younger man please clarify or check?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Whenever we answered questions previously, we made the point that the figures are not accurate unless they are in monthly arrears, and therefore this is the figure at the 1st of December, which is the end of November.
Just to clarify then, we don't have the end of December number, which would be exactly the 1st of January, if I understand the number correctly.
And that will be the 1st of January, and that is true of all the questions, as you will see in the other questions that is put.
Thank you.
Question number 104, the Honourable Ian Kenton.
Can the Minister of Public Finance advise that the people ordered to report application on any point from the Attorney General under the Public Finance Control and Audit Act, Section 5, Subsection 1E, in the period from December 2011 to December 2015, inclusive?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, I am informed by the Attorney General that no such clarification has been served by the Principal Auditor in the period mentioned in the question.
Speaker, would it be in order for me to ask if the Financial Secretary has asked for some advice from the Attorney General?
Well, Mr. Speaker, you can ask it, but it's not going to be answered because I've asked the Attorney General and not the Financial Secretary because that's what we are asking the right question.
Question number 105, the Honourable Ian Fenton.
Can the Minister for Public Finance please advise the purpose of GSBA Limited, whose £11 million of issued ordinary share capital is 100% held by the Board of Trading Bank?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
I will answer with question 106.
Question number 106, the Honourable Ian Kenton.
Can the Minister for Public Finance please advise the whom Credit Finance Company Limited and the Volta Investment Holdings Limited Bank?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the purpose of USDA is principally to hold real assets. Credit partners and devote investment holdings bank with the government since the former USDA administration established that government companies are dealt collectively in their cash transactions by the Treasury.
Could the Honourable Member please clarify what he means by real assets? Is that real estate, simple assets, gold bullion? Some indication perhaps would be helpful. And in terms of the second question, by banking with the government, which also is not a bank, I presume he means savings bank.
By answer the second one, by government, I mean that the companies that he mentioned and others do not have separate bank accounts, but collectively all the cash is dealt with by the Treasury, and that was the system introduced previously, and the system has not changed since 2011. And as regards the assets, the biggest thing that asset in that is in fact the building of the savings bank, the mentioned building. And there are, you know, real assets because if you consider the way the account of the savings bank account, which is really the account of the special fund, there has never been a provision there showing anything other than the investment that the fund has made externally, as it were, with other people. And it's not like a company account that sells the assets and depreciates it. By putting things like the building or any other real asset in there, we will be able to reduce the value of the company and to be therefore more accurate reflection in the account. That is no longer doing it alone by having it in a company.
Thank you. I'll try to deal with each one topically. From my reading, maybe the number seems, I remember things properly, my reading of the Principal Auditor's Report in terms of government tax reserves, would you agree with me that the majority of the government tax reserves, which I can only take from the Treasury, are actually held as the Court of Savings Bank?
The tax reserves of the government are held in the savings bank, but the tax reserves can, in fact, and have been, if the Honourable Member looked in previous years, sometimes be less than the government technically owns, because part of it is owed to the government by companies, or sometimes more than the government technically owns, because the cash surplus of a company is, in fact, included to the government. So, in fact, it's simply that there is one single pot of cash which covers government departments, authorities, agencies, and companies.
The way I'm saying it, if I am correct, is that the Treasury has approved money with a collection from government agencies and government companies. The Treasury and part of the money or the government's total cash reserve, which would include the money that holds on behalf of companies, will be shown in his order of report into the total cash reserve and how those cash reserves are invested. And if I've read his order of report for 2014 correctly, would the member agree with me that the majority of that is invested in the same bank?
The government doesn't have to put it in the savings bank. It generally does, but in fact, there's nothing to stop the government, for example, having a direct bank account with NatWest or Barclays. What I'm telling you is that it is the government that opens those accounts and not the company.
No, I understand that. If I may come back to the investment by DSCA, and again, if I understand the number correctly, I don't remember correctly, what he's saying effectively is either a fixed asset, which is the building in which the savings bank is held. Could you explain to me how you reconcile that with the requirement to match the maturity profile of the public?
Well, because in fact, the 11 million is less than the money that belongs to the savings bank as it reports. The savings bank has more than 11 billion, which is better not to match to anything or anybody because it's its own money.
And if you think about that logic, that's a normal member would expect that he has to keep at least the value of the investment, 11 million in the reserve, and that he can't use that much out for the same bank that he's so close.
It is not the case that it has to be kept. It is the case that, as a matter of policy, the government intends to keep the profits of the bank in the savings bank. And the savings bank could have rented the property and had it part of the current expenses instead it chose to buy it and hold it in a company, and therefore that is reflected in the profitability of the savings bank.
I understand that, but that wasn't my question. My question was, the savings bank act specifically provides that the, and directs, in fact, the financial secretary to ensure the investment matches closely as possible to the maturity profile. Now, obviously, the savings bank act does not have a maturity date. As you just said, well, you have more profits in the bank than you have deposits, therefore it's not an issue. But by extension of that argument, we have to agree that you have to keep those reserves to cover that success.
The honourable member knows the savings bank is programmed as part of government policy to keep on increasing its reserves and retaining it and not distributing it to the shareholder that is the government. And therefore, what the maturity dates are about are the matching of the maturity of the external investment with the repayment of the debentures to the public. The Honourable Member is talking as if the savings bank tomorrow, for example, in the month of December, will have over £40 million maturing. And that has been repaid because we have had investments that have matured on the same day to enable it to invest it. You know, the position was that 11 million represented maturing debentures, and consequently the bank has to sell the ability to be able to pay off the debentures. That is separate to the amount because it's in excess of what is, if you like, owed to savers.
I think I fully understand that. What I'm saying is that the Honourable Member could not, or he can't be allowed under the same fact that actually, as you were, pay a dividend to the government, that would eliminate the reserves such that they reduce below the cost of that fixed asset at 11 billion. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a matching maturing amount.
I should say that Honourable Gentlemen should be careful that they are beginning now to debate. I mean, that was expressing a point of view. It wasn't framed as a question. It can be framed, perhaps, as a question. Does the Honourable Minister agree with me that? So I certainly don't need to come to the question. Otherwise, you're making a statement. Like you said, that pre-phrase it slightly, and then you're covered perfectly by the rule.
Very good advice, Mr. Speaker, because if you ask me if I agree with him, the answer is going to be no. So, I'm trying to satisfy his curiosity, and I don't mind doing it, and I don't think that I'm arguing with him or debating it. I don't quite well remember. The point is, of course, that the choice was open to the savings bank, right? Not to invest in the building, for example, which I told you is the biggest element, and instead, the building would have been owned by somebody else or some other company, and there would have been a rental payment. And therefore, there would have been a deduction in the annual surplus. The view was taken that given the return that we get, the return on the building would have been better if there was no rent, and therefore the asset had to be sold in some way. The only way that we can sell the asset in the balance sheet is the Honourable Member looks at how special funds work. Because there really is no way of dealing with a building. I will not say that it's a company owns a building, and the value of a company reflects the value of the underlying assets into which the savings bank fund has in fact invested some of its reserves. And we do it, and we've done it, frankly, because we've done an exercise that shows that it, instead of doing it that way, we have not spent our own money as it were and invested in that, would have been a less favorable return. So it's just a question of being intelligent about investing money.
I think the honourable member and President Goldman, I think I satisfied myself on the point in the BSPA. If I may return to the question of banking and credit finance and what the message holding, would the honourable member agree with me that if credit finance, for example, or also investment holdings, for example, have any surplus cash that they then deposit in the Treasury, that the Treasury in turn would deposit that cash with what savings bank, certainly given the profile as reported by the principal auditor for March 2014, where it would appear that the bulk of the government's cash is in savings bank?
It is true that the bulk of the government's cash and the cash of the company is in the savings bank, because it makes more sense to have it there than to have it with another bank and not get any interest. We instead it's best to maintain the liquidity in the savings bank. The whole point of the question, as I understand it, is that the honourable member wanted to know whether there were separate bank accounts, and the answer is no.
I think I don't know whether you allow this for the final supplementary. Would the honourable member agree, or perhaps you disagree, that it is entirely possible to increase the deposit base of the savings bank by causing the savings bank to make investments in a government company, and that government company in turn depositing surplus cash in Treasury to in turn deposit it with the savings bank?
It is theoretically possible to do that if one had nothing more worth way to do than do it. I can assure you that that hasn't been done since 2011, and I don't know that it has been done before 2011. But I think the proportion of the government money in the savings bank in 2011 was higher than it is now.
Question number 107, the Honourable Iron Clinton.
Can the Minister for Public Finance please advise the financial terms of the score that is granted lease in the land upon what the upon which the LNG storage tank is situated?
I'll say the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, this matter is currently part of the ongoing negotiations with the company.
Mr. Speaker, one member has cast his mind back to the Chief Minister's budget address of 2015, where, if I may say, the Chief Minister, another great guiding income for us, he will be fighting in private place LNG storage, reclassification banking facilities, government discussion into the policy justice, policy license finance, the power of our parties, giving the government the option to invest in such a facility that not require us to do so. Could you all remember advise whether the government is taking up any such option, or whether the land is going to be payment for some type of facility to participate in the LNG operation?
I can tell him that there will be an investment by the government, but I cannot tell him the nature of that investment because of those negotiations have not finished.
Question number 108, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Can the Minister for Public Finance please advise the total anticipated cost of the power station project, and how this amount could be financed, given that only £1,000 is provided for in the estimate for 2015?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the new power station is a design and build contract. assess the precise cost, turn gives his variation to the design, which is wonderfully appreciated and iterative process. At present, it is projected to cost around $73 million. Ongoing negotiations are underway to finance the majority of the cost through a government-owned company.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the cost of the power station, have the costs that are ancillary to the power station, for example, the Landwehr Commission, you now know that part of the power station is being built in the Landwehr Commission, has all that already been paid, or does it have to be paid?
I can't tell the Honourable Member what has been paid until now, unless he tells me the information I want and I ask the people who are doing it. All I can tell him is that the negotiations for the funding are still ongoing, and there are things that have happened already, but that doesn't mean that the invoices that have arrived have been paid or not, without, you know, the Honourable Member putting a direct question, which I can then get a specific answer on a specific date.
Does he accept that in the light of the answer that he gave to question 102, in relation to, for example, reserves, which stand at £16.6 million as at the end of December 2015, that the government really, and indeed net debt, stood at £431 million, very close to the $457 million debt limit. But really, the government, as the law stands today, doesn't have the cash reserve, nor does it have the borrowing capacity in order to pay for the power station and the cost of $773
million. Well, I accept that is accurate to the same extent that it was when it was in government, when they produced the list of projects of $1 billion, and at the time they didn't have $1 billion. And the reality of it is that, of course, the government has got targets that it publishes ahead of time, and we work to achieve the target by the date of the target. And if the Honourable Member will see how this thing fluctuates, in fact, if you ask me for one day's figures, then the following day could be higher, could be lower, because it's all about whether bills are being paid on a particular day, or receipts arrive on a particular day. But the reserves of the government are not relevant to this because I've already told them it will be done through a company.
Just to speak about it, it's done by a company, either capitalized by the government through cash that the government holds, the word that the Honourable Gentleman doesn't like us to pronounce, ergo, it's either from cash reserves of the government, or alternatively, that company may borrow itself and may then effectively pay for it, but from borrowing that the government, that the government-owned company basically undertakes. So, at some stage, of course, the government then has to step in, and unless that company is a profit-making company, the government would have to step in, or the government would have to be some kind of guarantor in order to pay for that loan, £73 million. A government-owned company, unless that government-owned company produces some very serious profits, it's very difficult to see or consider a situation where that government-owned company is going to be able to pay £73 million to build this particular power station.
Well, I think the Honourable Member, Mr. Speaker, appears to have forgotten the system that they invented, which did not exist prior to the GSB being in government, which was, in fact, as was explained at the time by the then Chief Minister, the greatest ever living libertarian, the position is that when this is done with a company, there is a supposed higher element of risk that the lender is taking, precisely because it is not government debt. And that was said about, for example, the money that was raised for the cap-out and the money that was raised for the hospital purchase and for the establishment of the building in Europe for the novel converted into a hospital. So the government then explained that, in fact, the agreement entered by a company with a local bank, for example, which involved 20 years where there was an annual payment and it involved a reducing element of interest on the balance of the loan, because it was really like a repayment mortgage where every year they paid off part of the original cost, and therefore the $50 million of the hospital had been paid off like that. And the CAPAC have been using that same system, and those systems were introduced as an alternative to public debt by the previous government, and it was explained in this parliament to questions that I put that in those cases there was a slightly higher element paid because, in fact, there was not a government guarantee attached to that. And that still is the system that is in place, the one they came up with.
So, effectively, what we're talking about is the incorporation of a government owned company that enters into some kind of lease arrangement in relation to the power station, whereby the power station is paid, there's a lease payment, for example, every single month or every 6 months or whatever, and over 20 years, then the sum of £773 million will be paid over 20 years, the £73 million. Is that what the Honourable Gentleman is envisaging, the way that this is going to be funded?
This is the nature of the funding model that is being looked at. That is still not 100% certain, because it's only one possibility, but it's the most likely one, and that would be related to the assets, that is, the real assets that are being purchased. It will not cover everything, because there are certain things that are not covered by this kind of agreement. And the same has been done, you know, with other things. There has been an element of things that are real assets, like construction, but other things that are not included and not possible to include. But we're looking at using the mechanism that we, you know, that is how we look at.
I understand, and indeed we've had exchanges, he and I, in relation to CFI arrangements now for the last, I think it's 13 years. You may recall that in 2003, when the then GSD government funded the hospital using a PFI arrangement, the public debt then was £78 million, and the legal borrowing limit was £100 million. And one of the points that I was making was, well, you know, actually, if you look at this PFI arrangement, it's a way in which you can supplement the legal borrowing limit, because if you had to borrow directly, you would be able to sell the 100 million. At the time, he and the Honourable, the Chief Minister, were at Ivan, he was leader of the opposition in relation to this. But you see, the difference then with now is that there were commenting adversely on the use of PFI arrangements, because it's a form of hidden debt, and were recommending that PFI arrangements be brought onto the balance sheet so that you can have a real a realistic debate on the real state of what the indebtedness of a community or a nation is. One or two, me included, even though, you know, I didn't understand matters then as the Honourable Gentleman. Now, the United Kingdom, for example, includes PFI arrangements as part of the calculation of public debt. Is the government intending to go down the route of the United Kingdom and do that as well?
So I don't know whether it falls into the definition of PFI arrangement or not, because in fact, the former Chief Minister used to argue that what we did in our previous term in office with the incinerator had been a PFI arrangement without us knowing that it was a PFI arrangement, where somebody came in, built something, and ran it. I don't think that losing assets where there is a payment over the life of the asset, which involves interest and repayment of the original sum, is necessarily the same as a PFI arrangement. But in any event, I don't accept that this is part of the public debt, and I'm not sure what is right in saying that things like this in the United Kingdom are included in the public debt. But even if they are, they're certainly not included in the public debt of everybody else in Europe. And in any event, even if we were to include this in the public debt, it would be nowhere near the 75% of GDP that the UK has. Or, for example, the ratio of debt to GDP that the third biggest economy in the planet has, which is 240% of GDP in Japan. So, this thing, from my perspective, as the Honorable Member knows, I view it on the basis that if you raise money, for example, to invest in a capital, which is the argument that was used by the government when they did it the first time, and that, in effect, produces an income stream, then really, this is not money that you're wasting in order to produce a public service. This is whether the government should be in the business of running capital or running other things into the tradition. But the nature of that transaction is that it would be no different if it was a private investor raising money to build a car park and then use the money that is produced by the utilization of an asset to repay the cost of the asset. From an economic point of view, whether it's a public entity or a private entity that is doing the transaction doesn't alter the nature of the transaction. And therefore, there are assets that are assets that have got an effect on the economy and on the output of the economy. And it's not an unreasonable way to do it. And I think the real use of public debt is when you are doing things like schools or things like that, which at the end of the day, assets that you create, which after they've been created, don't produce income, because they produce what is at a cost. And there is no way, therefore, of amortizing that asset and saying, well, I'm going to pay it out of the income that it produces. So, you know, I don't accept the analysis and the logic of the analysis, but I accept that he has that view and is entitled to have it, and he used to have it when he used to criticize the GSB in 2003, and at the time he criticized me for agreeing with the GSB. And now he's criticizing me for disagreeing with the GSB, now he's with the GSB.
When he talks about all these countries having huge debt, of course, a percentage of large percentages to GDP in terms of debt, of course, in the United Kingdom. For comparable, we have, for example, Bermuda, which is an overseas territory that has 36% debt to GDP, are in financial difficulty because at the end of the day, one also has to look at different factors, not just simply ratio of GDP to economy, debt to economy. We've also got to look at income and other issues like that. But just examining a little bit further how the model that is going to be used in relation to this particular power station, is the government exploring that the power station is going to be owned by the French company over the 20-year period, and the French company perhaps is going to be selling electricity, or is it going to be simply a straightforward lease? Can you give us some more information in relation to that?
Particularly when it is ready to run, there is an initial period where the French company will be involved because there is a period of warranty and a period when our people from the old generation station will be working alongside theirs, but I think that is a maximum of a year. And then after that, they go and we take over. So the whole issue is that the operation will be run by the local electricity authority, and once the thing is completed, it will be owned by the Gibraltar Electricity Authority to the extent that, like anything else, if tomorrow we buy in the old station a generating set, and that generating set is financed by an arrangement where we are paid, if you like, in installments. Technically, the engine is mortgaged in support of that facility, but that's the only element.
Question number 109, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Can the Minister for Public Finance please advise the total anticipated cost of the Urban Wastewater Treatment Plant project, and how this amount would be financed given that only £1,000 was provided for in the estimate for 2015-16?
I'm told the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, there is no anticipated cost in respect of this project in the current financial year.
Would I be correct in assuming then that the Honourable Minister saying that that project will not proceed in the financial year 2015-16?
The Honourable Member's original question is, how are we going to finance it in the current financial year with £1,000? And the answer is, we're not even going to spend £1,000 in the current financial year. We'll have to wait till we see next year's budget to see what will happen after the 1st of April.
That may be the case. I understand what the Honourable Member is saying, but do we have any indication of what the cost might be?
He's asking me, how am I going to pay if there's only £1,000 in the estimate for this year? And I've answered his original question. The way I'm going to pay it is when the £1,000 in this financial year approved by Parliament, at that year's estimate, is not going to be spent. And if he wants to know how we're going to do next year, then I'm afraid he has to wait for the estimate for next year, which have not yet been prepared, because the submission can in at the end of January, and then it could be looked at by the Treasury, and then that exercise finance finishes with a figure, which will be, if there is a figure, will be there when he gets the book in April, and that's when he can ask for the question.
Thank you. But Honourable Member, if I recall correctly, the last election, the contract for this treatment plant were imminent to be signed, clearly we must have an idea. I mean, read my question carefully if you are in two parts. Please advise the total anticipated cost of the Wastewater Treatment project, and how it might be defined still in the next. So, really, I have two elements to that question. My first element is how much do you think it's going to cost? Simple as that.
I think we have the question, but he's aware, given that he's put so many different questions in other subjects, he's got put this one in two. Because as far as I'm concerned, he is curious to see how I'm going to meet what he expects to be an anticipated cost of his salary, more than 1,000, he's already got 1,000. And given that he is as minded as I am to spend as little as possible, I would have thought he would be glad that we're not even going to spend the 1,000.
I will call for this question next March. Thank you.
Question number 110, the Honourable E.J. Davis.
Mr. Speaker, can government provide details in respect of any government-sponsored student currently participating in the Maritime Cadet Training Scheme, indicating at what stage they are in the training, an estimated completion date, together with qualification aimed to be attained?
I'm told the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, there are currently no students participating in the scheme. Mr. Speaker, last time I asked this question, probably a year and a half or so ago. This is a cost that results at the time that we're in sort of the drafting stage and about to place out an advert to see if there are any takers into the scheme or whatever. Does the Minister have any information of where anybody took on that offer and has probably left the scheme because he's subsidized there and none at the moment, but maybe since the time I asked the question to now, some did engage and are no longer
and including courses. Is he aware of any of those statistics?
As far as I'm aware, there has not been an interest from anybody expressing in the field, as soon as the Honourable Member knows it's not funded by the government, it's funded by the industry.
And one other one, Mr. Speaker, on a supplementary, he made up. Does the government intend perhaps in the short term future to advertise again to see if there would be an interest arising from potential students?
It's not that there has been any change of policy. I think the people who are involved in doing in running this, you know, put out an advert, I think that an advert has to be put out, or they test the interest in some other way. All I can tell you on the Monday is that I've asked a question from those concerned that he's asking me, and the answer that I've given him is the answer that they gave me. But it's not that there has been a decision to discontinue this or to discourage anybody.
I hope all members agree that I theoretically perhaps once a year ask this type of question, because it would even enable him when he meets with those who are traditionally being contributors in some of the scheme, you know, to make him aware that there is supposedly, from what I hear from some youngsters, there is some type of interest. And it would be great, you know, with one thing really long term plan, in the same way that the girls are now both very proudly having a Gibraltarian like Captain the Fourth, you know, if one wants him to be succeeded by looking at Gibraltarian, we need to ensure that we do have the right people, the right education in that particular area. And he and I think from the same hinge, we like to make sure that our people attain as high education in their areas of professional expertise as possible.
We'll make further inquiries in this and let the Honourable Member know, and also perhaps what has happened to those who are asking it.
Question number 111, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm what academic and vocational or skills-based training courses, programs, are available to those persons currently serving custodial sentences or case sentences in their will, and to those who have completed a term of imprisonment?
Mr. The Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Speaker, I will answer with question 112 and 113.
Question number 112, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm what support is available to those persons who have completed drug rehabilitation and are in need of remuneration employment?
Question number 113, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can the government confirm what support is available to those persons who have recently completed a term of imprisonment to access housing, employment and education of children?
I'm to the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, persons serving sentences are also in prison receive regular counselling from a professional qualified counsellor provided by the training company and are followed up by visits and release. Part of the process, they are encouraged to take up training for employment that is available and for which they are suitable on release. Whilst they are at Monastic Prison, training is offered with a course currently delivered on carpentry, which can lead to level 1 city and deal certificate on maintenance operation. Additionally, there are English, math, and Spanish courses up to GCSE standards delivered to those who are willing to undertake them. Those who have completed a term of imprisonment are encouraged to participate in the training programs for the construction industry, which would involve them actually being taken on and paid the minimum wage. Persons who complete the drug rehabilitation program in Brussels Fund and register with the Employment Service are on registration referred by the Employment Service to the EDEC training system. They are then interviewed to explore past employment history, employment experience, and future employment expectations. Daily vacancies are identified as suitable and individuals sent to those vacancies. Some are additionally supported by the in-house councillor, which is also serving the prison, as they may have been previously serving custodial sentence. So sometimes we get, you know, the connection between the guard and the custodial sentence. But with that access to housing, it does not follow that because a person has been recently completing a term of imprisonment, his housing situation has changed. Any person entitled to apply for government housing is treated according to his or her requirement, irrespective of whether they have served a prison sentence or not. If the person is homeless, the procedure for dealing with homeless persons would apply again without discrimination.
Can the honourable gentleman confirm what education opportunity is? I think he answered the question with respect to housing in relation to question 113, but not in relation to education opportunities.
Well, I don't know whether one can say, you know, that learning a class is not an educational opportunity, but I think the education opportunity is covered by the offerings that are made to English, math, and Spanish classes at PGCSE level, which doesn't prepare you specifically for a particular trade, but you might improve the literacy and numeracy skills, and that is also available. But it's not something that all the people want to take up, to be quite honest.
Thank you for the honourable gentleman's answer to those three questions. I thought we'll go back to yesterday when Mr. Lacoon, Mr. Justice, answered the question. I put it to him that as part of getting people back into work after they had significant problems with either offending or reoffending, the key to this is getting people back into work. Would the honourable gentleman agree with me that we need to be doing more than just encouraging people back into work? Offering English, math, and Spanish is a good thing, of course it's a good thing, but surely we should be doing much, much more than offering just skills in carpentry. There must be other forms of IT, given the advances in the world of technology, that we should be offering further types of courses that will able to engage people and get them back into work, rather than looking simplistically at issues such as carpentry or language-based skills. Wouldn't the honourable gentleman agree with me that we need to look at other ways to encourage people back into work with different types of courses that target the needs for opportunity to resource other workplaces? Thank you.
Well, as the honourable member may know, the focus in training has been from 2011 that the training is driven by an analysis of the labour market on the basis that, frankly, people expect that they've got a better chance of getting a job if they get training than if they don't. And if you train them for something for which there is no work, then at the end of the day they come back and say, well, why have you trained them? So, in effect, it's by analyzing the skills shortages in the market and analyzing the frequency of vacancies that are open in certain areas that the numbers of places offered in different trades is defined. Everybody that comes out of serving as a soldier sentence is given the same opportunity than somebody that hasn't been in prison. It's not that you get better treatment for having been in prison than you would, because otherwise the guy that doesn't go to prison will say, well, do I have to go to prison then to get better treatment? But people should not be discriminated, and of course we make a particular point of offering them training while they're still in prison, so that if they're willing to take on training, there is no gap between the release and the employment, because the training company will offer employment to them immediately they come out if they're prepared to do it as part of the training program. In addition, we generally are prepared to give a longer period of time for trainees to come out of prison on the basis that they have got greater difficulty, because normally employers will be more reluctant, and therefore, in order to provide a more attractive incentive to the employer, we would normally negotiate with an employer that we would help to finance the training period longer if we want to encourage him to take somebody that has come out. But I think the most important thing from the perspective of what we are trying to do to help stop people you know, falling back into finishing up in prison is that, in effect, during the counseling period, we do everything we can to persuade them that the best way is for them to immediately, they come out, they come to us, and we see what we can do to get them employed as soon as possible after they come out. Because we see that it's the gap between the coming out and the getting a job that is when they're most vulnerable to, you know, getting into bad habits. Yeah.
Thank you, Jim, for the answer to that question, a lengthy answer to that question. I'd just like to explore in a bit more detail certain aspects of that, because the Minister for Justice talked about statistics yesterday that 58% of people currently at the prison are re-offenders. When you contrast that with the many thousands of people, and I don't say that in any way to criticize them, it's a very difficult process, in fact, with a number of building projects under the government of but if one reconciles the fact that there are 12,000 people moving each day through the frontier to work in our jurisdiction, is it not right that we should consider analysing those jobs that those people are filling to try to see whether those people that are coming out of prison or people that are in prison that are in need of those skills, that we do much, much more to facilitate them going into those skills? And what I mean is, the Honourable Gentleman is looking at the skills that are within the community. I think it's right to say that, and I think it was reported recently in the press, that many thousands more people are crossing the frontier to access opportunities in Gibraltar. And it is right also to confirm that every opportunity should be open to everyone, irrespective of whether someone's undergoing it here has completely fulfilled the sentence or not. But what attempts has the government made to increase the possibilities and give them better opportunities for getting back to what the cycle of crime?
We know the events when it comes to competing in the labour market, because we've got, you know, people not just who are born in the hinterland, but born anywhere in Europe, whose background we know nothing about, and that therefore when they come here they start with a clean sheet, whereas if you are a local, everybody knows your life history, and that counts against you because, you know, you get stigmatized and banded. And it makes, so what we try to do to compensate for that is basically encourage people to try to get them started in a job on the minimum wage, which is what we pay for training, which in a way is really generated the most we can pay. There are 9,000 people on the minimum wage in the Delta, which you can hardly be paying people more than the minimum wage while they're training. And then say to them, when you put your training, you'll get a wage cut because your employer will only pay you a minimum wage. But by trying to persuade them to go straight in, I think it's the best way of, in effect, getting them into that job before the job goes to an outsider. But if there is a problem of resistance on the part of prospective employers, and it's not getting away from that, and the only thing we can do is try to change that attitude from the part of the employer and accept that everybody's got to be given an opportunity, you know, when they settle their debt with society and have an opportunity of building up their lives again. And certainly, as far as we are concerned, the money we invest in doing that is money well invested.
I couldn't agree more in relation to putting on our resources where people can get back into work after a long period of offending or attending in prison. Well, the reason why I asked the question is so far as access to housing and employment education opportunities, of course, everyone should be afforded if they have the need to access housing. I do quite an interest that I've had a recent experience with a number of individuals that have gone through rehab successfully and entered the aftercare facility successfully. But it's the issue of obtaining housing, employment opportunities, and education opportunities as well, which is increasingly, I find, from my experience, I don't know if they're my interest in it from clients I've had in my professional capacity, but it's difficult for them to access those three, and that is why I raised the question. And insofar as housing opportunities, I asked the Minister of Housing yesterday as to whether there's any way in which we can encourage or at least give some special treatment. I understand that's not going to be the case at the present time. But I just would highlight the problem that I've experienced and people have said to me that coming out of prison is a difficult process. They want to get back into a life free of crime and reoffending. And that is why I raised the point that clearly the government should now be looking at more of a joined-up approach in relation to accessing those opportunities and those services, which they will certainly need for them and their families.
Well, I don't think there's any political difference between us as to what the objectives should be. And, you know, however much we want to be doing now, there's always ways of improving it. And certainly, you know, but one is a difficult issue because, you know, the people sometimes say, well, look, if somebody comes out of prison, they seem to be getting more attention than if somebody goes out of prison. So you're a law-abiding citizen, and therefore you have to wait in a queue longer than somebody else. In the area of training, we don't have that problem because the training that is provided in anticipation of people getting employment because the jobs have already been identified. And therefore, it is not that if somebody from prison is given training, somebody else that has not been to prison will be discriminated against and not get the training. The training is based on the availability of people and the availability of jobs, and there are more jobs than people, otherwise we wouldn't have anything to work on. I think in housing it's a different issue, because it would be a very difficult thing, I think, to, you know, I mean, there is already a provision for treating social cases and treating homeless people. And the category of homeless and social cases cannot then be subdivided with a higher priority given to ex-prisoners, I think, without creating, in my view, other problems. But secondly, you know, I take note of the views of the Honourable Member and the ways in which we can do more than we're doing already. The Honourable Member can just appear that it will be done.
May I, Mr. Speaker, because I'm very interested in the answers that the Chair of the House has provided that. At the very beginning of his answer, he mentioned that there was counseling provided to the training company. I'm not certain, Mr. Speaker, whether that was applicable to persons who have completed the class of education or those who have completed the term of imprisonment. And my confusion, as I told him now, was sort of further exaggerated on my part, when later on he spoke about an in-house counsellor. Perhaps the Honourable Member can clarify that and we can have a clearer vision. The employment, the Economic Development and Employment Company has had a counsellor working at the prison part-time, and that counsellor, in addition to visiting people while they're serving a sentence, continues to maintain contact with them, visit them, or they come and see him at our premises after they have been released. And the people who've been in British Farm and then come and register them as well and have referred to us for training opportunities also have the opportunity of having the support and the advice of the counsellor that is there, because the counsellor sees people on the premises and in the prison, but he doesn't see the people in British Farm at British Farm because they've got their own in-house situation. So the in-house counsellor that I'm talking about is only just one person in the part-time.
Yes, that's what I said. But if you think of this, really, it's just about an update on the situation of, as the Minister may or may not be able to confirm to me. I know we used to have a council within employment services. Are we talking about the same person, or are we talking of additional council? Because the council was inside employment services was also very, very keen and very able in helping people prepare even their CV and preparing for sort of a job application process. Are we talking of a people in the system or just an enhancement?
But I was actually doing voluntary work before, perhaps, in the time of the Honourable Member. And I mean, people get help with the CV, but they don't have to make it. Like, they've done it, you know, almost routine thing every time somebody goes to their employer and comes to us from the training point of view and gets interviewed, and we help to prepare the city because that enables us to evaluate what they can see who
likely to be suited for. And the way that this works is that when employers are contacted about a vacancy, they are offered a selection of 3 or 4 or 5 individuals, depending on the kind of vacancy it is and on the supply of labor that we got, on the basis that if they find one of those people suitable, then they will get financial support as an inducement to take them on, and in the knowledge that initially there is a period when the employee is not as productive as it would be if he had been doing the job for a longer period of time. So like the employer is, if you like, encouraged to take a less experienced employee as opposed to a more experienced one that's coming from outside. Well, we try to balance the cost to the employer by agreeing the period of training that is required. And if there are people with, problems that make it more likely that the time that they will need will be longer, then that's supposed to be a purpose. We agree a longer period, taking into account that perhaps somebody else might be able to gain the level of experience in a shorter time, and somebody has come out from drug rehabilitation or whatever might be longer to do it, and the employer would then be, if you like, inclined not to take somebody that would be, if you like, less productive over a longer period of time. So the assessment that is done by the evaluation of the counselor and by helping people with activities helps us to try and match the skills of availability with the requirements of the employer. In that exercise, we're using somebody that is a highly experienced and qualified person, and that does the work for us by getting an hourly fee on a part-time basis.
Mr. Speaker, just a very quick question at the back of that. One of the questions is 112 is in relation to what support that is offered in relation to this person completing further rehabilitation and the need to get them back into work. I think the counselling that the Honourable Gentleman is referring to is the type of counselling that gives people who serve the custodial sentences in those prisons an insight into their criminality, an understanding of why they have committed those criminal offences, and therefore how to make reparation and remedy that situation so they can get work and get a job in the future. I think that's the type of counselling, for the avoidance of doubt, that's the type of counselling I think that the Honourable Gentleman is referring to, isn't it?
Remember that the counsellor that we have provides what he said while they're in prison and continues to provide a follow-up, which is more helping them to adjust having come out of prison. And that if the people that have come out from that rehabilitation feel that it would be helpful to them to also sit down and talk to the counsellor, since the counsellor is in the premises, we don't say to them, well, no, you can't see the counsellor because I haven't been to prison. You know? But the system is predominantly and has been predominantly introduced with a view to helping the reinsertion into a normal working life of people who suffer the social sentence. But when people who come out from that rehabilitation come to us, then given that facility exists, if they want to make access to it and make use of it, then they're given the opportunity to do it. The point that I also made was, in fact, that it is quite often the case that people who come out of prison have also had that problem. You know? I'm just giving them a broad outline of how this will work, basically.
Again, I'm grateful for the answer to the question, and I'm familiar with the process in terms of counseling and the good work that counseling does insofar as trying to bring that individual back into society so that they don't reoffend. I'm just more interested in support and services available to people that commit criminal offences and then back into the community. It's quite clear from page 27 of the Gentleman's Manifesto that the measures that are in place to get people back into work are going to be further enhanced, and that's the commitment that the government has made in respect of reintegrating individuals back into work. If the Honourable Gentleman can, I'm not sure if he has information available, but you can explain what enhanced measures that are referred to in the manifesto will be made available to do that, to get people reintegrated back into work.
We one went into the election, or we are not expecting to complete the manifesto in the first 2 months. But in effect, what I'm saying to him is that by providing the service we've been providing, we are also a process where we ourselves learn what more can be done. So, you know, the Honourable Mayor has referred to the numbers that are here attending. Well, look, I think, I don't know what the nature of the answers that was provided before, but I think one needs to see whether there has been, over a period of time, an improvement in that ratio. But that would be the kind of thing that, you know, if we are investing money and investing resources and we see that this is not delivering the kind of improvement we all want to see, then we need to say, well, look, maybe we need to go back put our thinking cap on and see where else we could be doing things that we're not doing, which might be producing a more positive result than we have today. That's the kind of enhancement. But the enhancement would be, in effect, by expanding our own success rate compared to what was happening perhaps before we had the counselor.
Question number 114, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please provide a breakdown by comparing to the GDP calculation for the last 10 years, available years, as performed by the Statistics Office?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the final figures for GDP calculated by the income method for the last 10 years, 8 of which were when the Honourable Questioner's Party was in government, are as follows. The GDP for 2003-2004 was 560.39 million, of which the income from employment accounted for 322.21 million. Income from self-employment was 51.61 million. Gross trading profit of companies was 90.91 million. Gross trading surplus of government enterprises was 6.94 million.
If we go through the income method and the expenditure method, and bearing in mind that under the income method, he's already got to gross trading, the street rent, and then on the expenditure method, there's about 10 subcategories. For 10 years, it's going to be a considerable amount of information that's going to be provided and read out to the House. Can I invite the Honourable Gentleman to provide it by way of the schedule, just simply just the answer that we already have, which we can take as a schedule and then analyse it at a later stage. There's not going to be any supplementaries arising out of this.
Well, Mr. Speaker, you know my view that if a member opposite says the question is for our answer, do as well behaved as I am. In this parliament, I try to do what we ask me to do, which is to give them our answer. And if we have a multitude of written questions for written answer, I have to assume that he doesn't want a written answer. And that's why I read it to him, because I think that is what he's expecting me to do, and that's why he says he wants another answer. And as you know, I think that handing a piece of paper is not conducive to anybody that is in the audience, not many, or listening, or watching us, to know what is going on if all we do is say, well, Mr. Speaker, I now hand over a piece of paper. And that's the answer to every question.
I have the answer here. It's not excessively long.
Thank you. I only produce the income calculation because it is, in fact, both calculations come with the same result, but it's always been considered that the more accurate figure and more reliable figure, frankly, is the income side, because what happens with the expenditure side is that the figures are sort of rounded off in order to make sure that the two results are the same, on the premise that GDP assumptions are that every income is matched by expenditure, and the two and the net result of the GDP has to be the same, whether calculated by the expenditure method or by the income method. So in fact, it's only half as long. But if you want to have the expenditure, I can get that sent to him. But this is a more accurate system. I have been as far as government enterprises, as the honourable member correctly says. The next item, therefore, is rent, which was £89.84 million in 2003-2004, and therefore the total domestic income was £551.51 million, and stock appreciation or depreciation was -1.12, giving us a 54.39. This increased in 2004-2005 to 599.74 million, and this was the result of income from employment going up to 338.58 million, self-employment increasing slightly to 52.79 million, gross trading profits showing a more substantial increase to 111.77 million. Gross trading surplus of government enterprises was down, in fact, in that year to 3.3 million and rent up to 94.5. And the adjustment to the figure was 1.15 in depreciation. In 2005-06, the GDP increased to 656.51 million. The income from employment rose to 384.81 million. From self-employment, income went up to 56.77 million. Trading profit rose to 113.77 million. And government enterprise surpluses were 3.72 million, a slight increase from the 3.3 of the previous year. Rent was up to 98.62, and again the adjustment in appreciation was 1.18 minus. In 2006-07, income from employment reached 440.57 million. Self-employment rose to 61.69 million. Trading profits of companies came to 128.11 million. Gross trading surpluses for government enterprise was down to 3.28 million and went up to 107.63 million. The adjustment for that year was -1.21. In 2007-08, income from employment was 495 million, self employment increased to 66.83 million, trading profit was slightly down to 127.74, just under 100 million pounds. Government enterprises were up 4.68 million, and rent was up to 113.07 million. The adjustment was slightly up at -1.25. 2008-09, the total increased by nearly 90 million to 898.7 million pounds. Income from employment grew to 526.93 million. Self-employment was down to 51.93. Trading profit up to 197.89 million. Government enterprise surpluses up to 5.48 million, and went up to 117.76 million. The adjustment of by depreciation was 1.29 million. In 9/10, the total went above the 1 million mark for the billion mark for the first time. It was 1.012.58, of which employment contributed 542.40 million, self-employment 58.24 million, trading profit 274.79 million, trading surpluses of the government enterprises were 4 million, and rent was up at 134.46 million. The adjustment for depreciation was 1.33 million. 2011 saw the GDP grow to 1.082.19. The employment contribution grew by 40 million pounds to 582.11. Self-employment was down from 58 to 35.31. Trading profit of companies was up to 310.44 million, and there was a slight increase in the surplus of government enterprises from 4 to 4.77 million. Rent was up at 150.94 million, and the depreciation adjustment was minus 1.38 million. 11/12 was 1.201.31 million pounds. Of which employment contributed over 652.33 million. Self-employment 35.73 million. Company profit 349.61 million. Trading surpluses of the government enterprises 6.76 million. And rent 158.3 million. The adjustment for depreciation was minus 1.42. And the last year for which we have the final figure, which is 12/14, the total is 1,317.06 million pounds, 1.3 billion. Employment contribution was slightly up at 661.24 million. Self-employment was 48.34 million. Company profit was 444.28 million pounds. Government trading surpluses were 6.35 million. Rent 158.5. And the adjustment for depreciation was minus 1.45 million.
I said there was no supplementary, so I assumed actually that the last figure would be the figure for the end of 2014. I say that because when I asked for the GDP figures for the end of 2014, I think at the beginning of last year, I was told that those were going to be completed and calculated by November of 2015, which is the usual practice. When will that figure for the end of 2014 be available so that I don't have to ask this question again and I ask it the perfect justice? Because that's when I was told in November of 2015.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I asked the Statistics Office to provide me with final figures so that would not be subject to any further adjustment. I don't know how close they are to closing the 13/14. But I can send it to him if he wants me to send it to him without him having to ask a question of energy service.
I'd be very grateful if you did that. Thank you very much.
Finally, Mr. Speaker, possibly the only thing the Honourable Gentleman thought in his room before I move on to the title. Could I ask him perhaps to, if he can, explain the source of the company profit number that may drop on 12/13, 444 million OX. Is that a number that comes from Companies House? How did it derive? Do you know?
this is the single form that is compiled by the statistics office, and it's a figure that gets adjusted. This is why sometimes it's quite a long time before they're closed. But what, because when they do the first estimate, for example, if they receive 70% of the returns of company accounts, I'm not sure how the company accounts reach the statistics, whether it comes from the tax office or from other source. It's not that the companies are asked to submit that to the statistics office. They must be from some other department, and the most obvious and legible one would be tax return by company. What happens then is that at a certain point in time, when something like 70 or 75% of the known companies that are trading have made the return, the figure is then adjusted by an estimate in respect of the 25 that still haven't done it. When those 25 start coming in, you then get a situation where, in some cases, the estimated figure is too high and it means a drop, and in other cases, the estimated figure is too low and it means an increase. Because, in effect, it's an arbitrary estimation. They just say, well, look, if there are 100 companies and 75 have made so much profit, you just assume that the remaining quarter, on average, will make the same profit as the first 75. There is no logical reason why that should be so. By and large, it's not very far out, because the ones that come in higher tend to cancel out the ones that come in lower. But it does mean, in fact, that the final figure can sometimes be revised downwards as well as upwards when they finally decide, you know, to call it a day in terms of revising the limit.
If I may ask if one sort of question actually on that. In terms of the profits, would these, in his view, be taxable profits? Would it be something, or is it just profit to all companies rated in profit?
I don't think it's taxable profits, because, you know, a company may, in fact, have other things which reduce its tax liability, but if one were to reduce the profits that they have made, in effect, you would be understating the output of the economy. The output of the economy is the income received by companies predominantly, and if the annual bank member analyzes the figures, for example, for the last year, out of the 1.3 billion, 440 million is companies and 660 million is employees. So you've got 1.1 out of the 1.3 are the income of workers or the income of the employers of the workers. And the fact is that it doesn't necessarily mean that the 444 were taxed, because they might have had offsetting allowances or development aid or depreciation or whatever, but the output of the economy is made of the money that people are making either as owners of capital or as owners of labor, that is the essence of what the GDP is all about. The treatment of offshore companies is not reflected 100% here. That is what used to be offshore companies. So, in fact, there is doing away with the taxes from companies and having everybody paying tax now would have produced a huge increase in GDP calculations, because before they were not included. So I think what has happened is that the statistics office has ignored that change, and in effect, the companies that have been brought into the onshore field that were offshore before continue to be treated as to their income by giving more or less the same percentage reflected here that they were getting before. If that had not been done, then the year of the change would have been a massive increase.
I'm grateful to all the members of that application. It was exactly what I was trying to understand. Thank you very much.
Can I just ask one, because I too am finding this quite interesting.
Mr. Speaker, first of all, there are two questions. First of all, are we calculating GDP here in the same way, for example, the United Kingdom would calculate GDP in the United Kingdom? And just curiously, this is where my interest has been put in the explanation which you have given. Isn't there a limit of double counting in the sense that if you count the income of companies, basically before tax, the gross income of the company, and you're talking about as well, and you calculate gross income of the workers, well, that can't be the output into the economy because there's an element of income of the workers that is coming from some of the companies. That's what has sort of piqued my curiosity in relation to this.
Well, if it were the income of a company, you would be right, but it's not the income of the company, it's the profit of the company. And therefore, the income of the company is the same. So this is not that the Volta has sales of 4.4 million, it's that the Volta made 4.44 million, 444 million pounds was the profit made on what could be a turnover of 4 or 5 billion. And of course, the profit is accumulating workers' wages, electricity, water, the cost of the things that the business is doing. So the answer is, the honorable member would be right if this was a turnover of the company that it is. I mean, think over the UK Blue Book, which is available on the internet, and the Blue Book has always been sort of the Bible of the statistics of the disease, with certain adjustments because of the nature of the economy. I mean, for example, it's more of the culture in the bulk of it. So, in fact, our economy has got less diversity than the UK. The UK is a much more complex exercise because you get GDP collectively, and then you get, for example, regional GDP, and you also get figures on the output of certain industries or the agricultural industry or the service or the city. We don't do any of those things. So what is a massive exercise over there is a much more limited exercise over here. But the principle of how you arrive at the element really is quite simple because, I mean, at the end, what we're saying is this is the 1 billion is the amount of money that collectively our community earns.
Question 115, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, considering that this House has not met since last July, and the reasons for not having sat in September and October, whether it would enable work to proceed on the installation of a lift to facilitate access to this house, and there's no work seems to have taken place in the period since last July, is it still the intention of government to have this lift installed? And if so, when can the works be expected to commence?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. It remains the policy of the government to provide lift access to persons with reduced mobility into the Parliament chamber. The design and the location of the lift have both been studied in detail, and authority works have been carried out. The project is expected to commence in the new financial year.
That's understood, and thank you very much for that response. Is it likely to cause disruption to this house during the work as it was forecast to do last year?
The operating works have already been done. Before the project commences, it needs to go to GDC again because it is substantially different to the project was originally envisioned and it went to GDC some time ago. So it will be a different project to the once the at a technical level is been approved, then we'll be able to understand the kind of disruption that will be envisaged. But I'd say what we were looking at in September and October was an internal lift. Those who start would have been far more noisy and disruptive than if the lift turns out to be extended at the end of August.
just one last question, mate. So the current proposal would seem to be a reversion back to the original concept of an external rate.
I guess it's because the issues really have been, the first of all, the type of lift, whether it was internal or whether it was external. I think the Heritage Trust wanted to be satisfied that an internal star lift or a platform lift, whether it was possible to do this internally rather than externally, is now established that it's not. The other issue was the location of the lift, and what even the Heritage Log itself was divided to whether if it was going to be external, it would be on the Piazza side of the building, it would be on the Main Street side of the building. The design is obviously another issue in terms of, you know, what the structure would actually look like. And the heritage consideration, obviously taking into account that this is a listed building. So all those factors that have been in the melting pot over the last 2 months. And it is a family and unique design that will go to the city.
I appreciate that we still have to go to DPC, but have the Heritage Trust indicated that they are already happy with the design or satisfied with it?
So you can see that there has been very close consultation between the project manager regarding the Heritage Trust and the Heritage Department, and although they are, I'd say, divisions or a difference of opinion, the conversion that would not prefer a lift at all, and those who would depending on the option or the structure, on the design, and what it looks like. In the final analysis, it's going forward with in full consultation with all affected parties, and also the staff that we know has worked in the DPC, and whatever final conclusion they come to, and so it is expressed there in public that we would hear.
Answers to written questions, the Honourable Deputy Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I expect not to see any member of the House in that list unless they have a problem with their legs. It's been done for a specific purpose. The people who have a disability. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to table the answer to written questions numbered 1W1 to W24, 2016 inclusive. And Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House be now adjourn until tomorrow at 3 p.m. when we shall consider a number of bills.
The House will now adjourn to tomorrow at 3 p.m.